Sarah DeAy, and you're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. Sketch and improv shows tend to not need a lot, in the sense that most of the time, all you really need is a stage, someone to work in the music and the lighting, and a willing cast and suggestions.
Open the door. Seek new world. In here, security. 90.3 FM from Montreal.
Your census invitation has arrived in the mail. Your participation will help plan programs and services for your community. Your census, your community, your future. A message from the Government of Canada.
Okay, I gotta let you go. I have to get my Lake Magog vaccine.
Your Lake Magog vaccine?
Yeah, you know, I'm really looking forward to having the whole family to the cottage for my annual cookout.
Smart move. I'm gonna ask for the Montreal vaccine. I miss those last-minute get-togethers with my buddies.
Nice. Well, I gotta run. I don't think it protects against lateness.
Each vaccination brings us closer to these moments. Follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book an appointment at quebec.ca/COVID vaccine. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome to the May 13th edition of Grey Matters. Tonight on the show, we have a lecture from Alternative Radio entitled Hidden History of U.S.-Iran Relations. It was recorded in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in January 26th of this year. The lecturer is John Gazvinian. He's a distinguished historian and executive director of the Middle East Center at the University of Pennsylvania. His articles have appeared in Newsweek, The New Statements, and The Nation. He is the author of America and Iran, A History, 1720 to the Present. So without further ado, here's tonight's lecture on Grey Matters, The Hidden History of U.S.-Iran Relations.
Very little they know about the U.S. is that the U.S. had had a revolution against the British Empire, and they liked that, right? So when Iranians of the late 19th century look at the U.S., they almost see a more idyllic version of the West. They want a better relationship with the U.S. because they want to learn from the West. They want to learn. They want to, you know, kind of progress economically and so on, but not at the end of a gun barrel. Not in this kind of coercive kind of way. So they look at the U.S. as a more idealized version of the West.
That's John Gazvinian, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features John Gazvinian on the hidden history of U.S.-Iran relations. The Islamic Republic of Iran and the United States have been at loggerheads ever since America's ally, the Shah, was overthrown in 1979. Iran was an important part of U.S. hegemony in the Middle East. In the decades since, Washington has waged cyber warfare, drone strikes, assassinations, sabotage, and sanctions against Tehran. Washington and its media echo chamber portray Iran as dangerous and threatening, even though it's surrounded by American bases and spends just a pittance on weaponry compared to the United States. But hostility wasn't always the norm. There's a rich and mostly hidden history where the two countries had friendly relations. It began several hundred years ago. Historian John Gazvinian said that relationship was filled with mutual admiration, warmth, and benevolence. Our guest today is John Gazvinian, a distinguished historian. He's the executive director of the Middle East Center at the University of Pennsylvania. His articles have appeared in Newsweek, The New Statesman, and The Nation. He's the author of America and Iran. He spoke in Philadelphia in late January 2021. The moderator was Shane Unger. And now, John Razvinyan.
So what comes to mind when we think of the history of U.S.-Iran relations? I think it depends very much on who you are and where you are, but a lot of us just don't know anything about the subject. We just simply know that the U.S. and Iran have a very negative and hostile and antagonistic relationship. If you have studied some of that history, you may know that there are two very pivotal dates that are often thrown out as kind of, I think of them sometimes as kind of original sins. The first, you know, the sort of original moment where one country became disillusioned or angry with the other. Those two events in the United States, especially, it's the 1979 to 1981 hostage crisis. So there was a revolution in Iran. Iran, as some of you may know, has had a 2,500-year history of monarchy. The last king, or Shah, was overthrown in February of 1979 in a massive popular uprising, revolution, that brought in the Ayatollah Khomeini and the Islamic Republic, which remains in power to this day. And of course, as part of the dramatics and theatrics of that that revolution, 52 Americans ended up being held hostage at the American embassy for 444 days. It was one of the most traumatic episodes in recent American history, for those of you who remember it, never far from the TV headlines and so on. For Iranians, there's a different kind of original sin, which is often cited, which is the 1953 coup d'etat against Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, which was backed and in large part orchestrated, not entirely, but in large part orchestrated by the CIA. Mossadegh was a very popular prime minister at the time, very popular, especially with the modern middle classes and educated intellectuals and so on, but generally very popular in Iran. He had nationalized the oil industry, which had previously been in the hands of the British, and fought a kind of two-year running kind of feud with the British about this. And eventually the British managed to convince the United States to help them, or to really actually to, you know, assist them really in overthrowing Mohammad Mossadegh. And that is often cited as a source of frustration for Iranians when they talk about sort of their history with the United States. I want to get us away from all of that tonight. When people talk about the history of U.S.-Iran relations, they immediately want to talk about these kinds of events. Well, why is that? It's kind of easy to see why that is, because these are events that make it possible for someone to blame, to cast blame and to create culprits, and to sort of say, ah, here's where the problem started. You started it. No, you started it. I think this is a really unproductive way of approaching history. That's not what history is about. History is not a weapon. History is not a courtroom drama. It's not about deciding who is at fault and who has to pay who kind of, you know, damages. That is not the job of a historian. And if we try to understand the history of U.S.-Iran relations, we have to get away from this mentality, this desire to look for culprits and people to blame. Because actually, when you start to look at this history, you realize it's much richer than that, you know. And to study it only looking for kind of looking for victims and oppressors and so on is doing a disservice to the history. I wanted to take the history back much further than that, because I think something very interesting happens when you do that, which is that you stop looking for blame. Like, there are a number of interesting things that happen. Okay, one of them is that you stop looking for who's at fault. The other interesting thing that happens is that you appreciate that for the overwhelming majority of these two countries' histories, this was a history of mutual admiration, mutual fascination, and even a kind of mutual idealization. These two countries had a really warm, positive impression of each other until 1953, basically, and then 1979. That dates back a couple of centuries, and even dates back to before they had any contact with each other. So the last 40 years of antagonistic relationships, the U.S. and Iran broke off ties officially in April 1980. That is not what characterizes the vast majority of these two countries' histories with each other. Here's one of the sort of interesting things for me about the history of these two countries. Most historians who have looked at this history begin their narrative somewhere in the 1940s. Because before that, before Pearl Harbor, basically the United States was an isolationist force. And it wasn't terribly interested in far-flung parts of the world like Iran. So there's a tendency, particularly among American historians, to say, well, because, you know, before the 1940s, you know, Iran might as well have been Antarctica for the State Department. So why do we need to study that history? Well, I think that's an interesting attitude to take, right? And I think it's a problematic way of approaching history, because basically what that is saying is that history only the history of these two countries only really begins when the United States becomes interested. Well, guess what? Iran was actually very interested in developing a closer relationship with the United States since the 1850s, since for almost a century before the 1940s. The Iranians were very interested in getting the United States more involved in their affairs. The very first disagreement that Iran and the United States ever had took place in the 1850s. And what was it about? Well, it was when the two countries were first starting to create, to sign and to negotiate their first treaty of friendship and commerce and navigation. They began negotiating in 1851, and they didn't finish negotiating until 1856, when they finally agreed and then ratified in 1857. Why did it take so long? It took longer than the nuclear deal took to negotiate. Okay? What was the dispute? What was the disagreement? Get this. Well, one of the key areas of disagreement was that the Iranians wanted the U.S. to become more involved in their affairs, and the United States said, no, we don't want to get too involved. At the time, the big problem Iran had was that the British had a lot of positions in the Persian Gulf, and the Russians were putting a lot of pressure on Iran from the north, from the Caspian. So Iran was being sort of sandwiched between these two great powers, and they were constantly interfering in Iran's affairs. So Iran wanted a neutral third force, as they called it at the time, to kind of this kind of neutral ally that it could wave in the faces of the British and Russians. And they thought the United States would make for a great third force. They wanted this alliance. And the Iranian government even asked the United States to provide them with American-made warships manned by American sailors flying the Stars and Stripes, right? They actually wanted the Stars and Stripes to fly from Iranian shipping in the Persian Gulf to send a message to the British. The U.S., of course, said, no, we're not getting involved in this. You know, there's a long history of isolationism and involved in entangling alliances and so on. But that was the dispute. It is almost surreal from where we sit today to look back only for a historian, this doesn't seem like a long time, only 170 years ago, and say this was the first disagreement between the two countries. This is where their relationship began, with the Iranians wanting the U.S. more involved and the U.S. saying, no, we don't want to get involved in your affairs. That alone I find pretty interesting, right? But, you know, we're talking mostly about politics right now. I wanted to go back even before that. This may seem like an eccentric or kind of silly, almost preposterous decision, but I actually decided to go all the way back to the 18th century, to the 1720s. And why was that? Why do I start in 1720? I started looking at some of the very, very first colonial American newspapers that were published. There were almost no newspapers in North America before 1720, very, very few. But around 1720, you started to get, particularly in Philadelphia and Boston, these publications. And lo and behold, it turns out, I was just looking for mentions of Iran or Persia, as they would have called it at the time. Turns out the first American newspapers were obsessed with Iran. Every single week there was something about Iran. Sometimes 20 to 30% of the newspapers were taken up with Iran. I mean, this absolutely blew my mind as I was looking at this. Okay, so why is that? Well, it turns out that, I mean, to some extent it was just because the big news story of the day in 1722 was that there was a big rebellion in the eastern portion of the Persian Empire, which is what Iran was at the time. That was a rebellion led by the Afghans who rebelled against, they were Sunni Muslims, and they rebelled against the Persian Empire, which was Shia, and was trying to force them to convert from Sunni to Shia. This was the big story of the day. I mean, one of the great world powers, one of the great empires of the day was collapsing, so it was being covered a lot by the newspapers. But what's interesting is the way they were covering it. The first American newspapers were absolutely pro-Iranian. They were cheering on the Shah and the Iranian government and the Persian Empire against what they called the usurpers, right? The evil Afghans that were trying to bring down this empire. Why? Well, a number of reasons, three or four reasons, but very, very briefly, and you'll see why I'm going on about this in a moment. But basically, one reason was they honestly believed that because there was this, that the Afghans were Sunni, that they must have been getting secret support, secret collusion from the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire was kind of like what Russia is today. I mean, every bad thing that happened, the American media said, oh, it must be the Ottoman Empire. Remember from your kind of school history lessons and so on, right? The long and complicated history that Christian Europe had with the Ottoman Empire. dating back to the Crusades. Remember that in 1683, the Ottoman Empire got to the gates of Vienna. They had conquered all of Southeast Europe, right? So they were the great, scary, you know, bogeyman of the day, right? The evil empire of the day. The terrible Turk, they used to, you know, the barbarous Turk, the evil Turk, right? That kind of stuff. White American settlers of North America would have seen themselves in 1722 as loyal British subjects and Christians and Christian Europeans, right? And remember, it had only been 40 years since the Ottomans were at the gates of Vienna. Only as long ago as the Iranian Revolution is to us, okay? So within people's lifetimes and memories. And the Ottoman Empire and the Persian Empire were the two great rivals of the region, right? And there was a Sunni-Shia quality to it, but there was also a political rivalry. So when Americans of the 1720s heard about this, they assumed, oh, this must be the Ottomans are colluding with the Afghans, the evil Ottomans, so the Persians are the good guys. And it is extraordinary to look at the coverage, right? Because you have these newspaper articles that try to explain to American readers in 1722 the difference between Sunni and Shia. They don't do a very good job of it, but they try. Well, that's pretty amazing. And they're telling you whose side we should be on. I mean, you think, why would anyone in Philadelphia or Boston care about this? But this is why they care. And it wasn't just the politics. It wasn't just, oh, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And there was more to it than that. It was a religious dimension. Okay? These were mostly Puritans in New England, right? And Puritans, Calvinists, they have a very literal reading of the Bible. For them, the Bible is like a reference book. It's the literal word of God. Remember, if you're in North America in the 1720s, you don't know that much about the Middle East. You don't have National Geographic to kind of teach you about things. So if you want to know about that part of the world, where do you go? You go to the Bible. And those of you who know the Bible, how does Persia come across in the Bible? Persia is the land of Cyrus the Great. This is in Ezra, book one, who Cyrus liberated the Jews from the Babylonian captivity. So he's a good guy in the Bible. It's also the land of the three magi, the three wise men. What are magi? What is a magus? Magi is plural of magus, M-A-G-U-S. Magus is what is known in Persian as a mog, which is a Zoroastrian priest. I don't know for sure, but probably the three wise men from the east were probably Iranians, right? That's how Iran comes across in the Bible. How does the Ottoman Empire? The Ottoman Empire doesn't exist, but they associated the Ottoman Empire with what was slightly to the west of the Persian Empire, which was Babylon. The evil Babylonians, Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel and the lion's den, all this kind of stuff, tearing down the Temple of Solomon, all this stuff. The Ottomans were seen as the heirs to the evil Babylonians. But it wasn't even just that, right? Who was in control of the Holy Land at this point? Who was in control of Jerusalem? The Ottoman Empire, right? All of the great biblical sites were being occupied, as the Christians would have seen it, and defiled and spoiled by these evil Muslim Ottomans. But just to the east of the Ottoman Empire was this kind of fairy tale land, this idyllic Persian kingdom that was not in control of any of the biblical sites, that was a rival of the evil Muslim Sunni Ottoman Empire, and that looked good in the Bible. So you can see why they liked Persia so much. They believed that the Garden of Eden was somewhere near where Mosul is today in Iraq, which is right around the border of the Ottoman and Persian Empire. So that is the easternmost biblical site. So they literally believe that the Persian Empire began just to the east of Eden. It was just out of harm's way. It was harmless. It was this fantasy oriental kingdom, you know, that was somehow seen as less evil and less Muslim somehow. I even saw a newspaper that described the rivalry between the Ottomans and the Persians as being a conflict between Muslims and Persians, which is a fascinating way of describing, right? Muslims and as if somehow Persians aren't Muslim. They've seen it because they're Shia and because the predominant Sunni Muslim world sees them as heretics and unorthodox. Therefore, they're good. They're somehow less Muslim. This is the way it was talked about. So why am I going on and on about this? Why? This is because this, for a couple of reasons. One is, this is before there is any contact between Americans and Iranians, this is the mental baggage that Americans brought to this. So when the very first American Presbyterian missionary, Justin Perkins, showed up in Iran 110 years later, in 1834. He wrote a long book about his time in Iran. These are the first Americans who actually went to Iran in the early 19th century. They were missionaries. There's a really striking word I noticed from Justin Perkins' memoirs. He described, when he first arrives in Iran, he describes the Salmas Plain around Urmia, where he first arrived in northwestern Iran. He calls it Edenic. Edenic. That's the word he uses. It literally is like a paradise. It reminds him of the Garden of Eden. There's a straight line between, you know, the Puritan ideology of the 17th century, the newspapers of the 18th century, right into the 19th century. And all of the Presbyterian missionaries who showed up in Iran, they had this kind of mentality about Iran, that it was just this kind of paradise, just to the east of Eden, just to the east of the Ottoman Empire. This mentality lasts for a really long time, right up to 1979. That's why I'm going on about this so much. Look at the way Iran is talked about in the 1970s or the 1950s and 1960s in America. Those of you who are old enough, you might have seen the blockbuster Hollywood film of 1954, I think it was, or 51, Haji Baba of Isfahan, right? This kind of orientalized fantasy kind of thing. You may have seen Orson Welles' documentary where he covers the 2,500-year anniversary of the Persian monarchy in Persepolis in 1971. It's called Flame of Persia. It is 100% within this tradition. Remember, in the 1970s, what did Americans think when they thought about the Middle East? They thought of the Arabs. And when they thought of Arabs, they thought of socialism, and they thought of wars with Israel and anti-Americanism. They thought of the Arab oil embargo and all these kinds of things. But here, to the east, just to the east of the Arabs, was this pro-American kingdom, east of Eden. I mean, that stuff stays. And the reason it stays, we don't have a lot of time for this, but the American Presbyterian missionaries who first arrived, they created some of the first Western style kind of schools and clinics. Okay, a lot of the Iranian elite of the 20th century were educated in American Presbyterian schools. Okay, so this stuff has a lifespan and an afterlife. So I talked a lot about the early American mentality towards Iran. What about the Iranian mentality towards the U.S.? It's actually this kind of a homologue, a kind of a similarity. It doesn't come until a bit later, though. In the 1720s, the Iranians, when they look at America, they don't know much about it. They just think it's this kind of wild, savage land full of cannibals and so on, the New World. But Iranians do have a version of this kind of what I would call almost like West of Eden, going in the other direction. But it comes about 100 years later. It comes in the late 19th century, in the 1860s, 70s, 80s. Why? Because around that time, the Iranians are struggling with the British Empire and the Russians. And they're looking for this third force, as we talked about earlier, right? This is the reason they're looking for a third force. Why do they think of the United States? Again, by the 1860s, 70s, 80s, the Iranians have now seen, they've now had American Presbyterian missionaries living in Iran for 30, 40 years. They've seen that these people have just come and built schools and clinics and so on and taught literacy and these things. But their government, the American government, hasn't even set up an embassy. They're not interested. That is really interesting to Iranians because that is so different from the way the British or the French or the Belgians or the Russians are acting. In the late 19th century, the Iranians look around them and they see these Americans that are just seem to be there for altruistic reasons. They're just kind of, you know, trying to help. I mean, yeah, they're also trying to convert people to Presbyterian Christianity, but, you know, they're also trying to build schools and clinics. And most importantly, the U.S. government is not involved. They're not coming in with this imperialistic mentality. The very little they know about the U.S. is that the U.S., less than 100 years earlier, had a revolution against the British Empire. And they like that, right? So they think this is a country that's anti-imperialist, that understands their struggle with the British and so on. So when Iranians of the late 19th century look at the U.S., they almost see a more idyllic version of the West. They want to develop. They want to progress economically and politically. They know that the West is outpacing them and that, you know, that they're falling behind and so on, the Industrial Revolution. But they don't want to. You know, they don't want to bring in advisors and you know, consultants from Britain or France or whatever. They want a better relationship with the U.S. because they want to learn from the West. They want to learn. They want to, you know, kind of progress economically and so on, but not at the end of a gun barrel. Not in this kind of coercive kind of way. So they look at the U.S. as a more idealized version of the West, like a better version. And isn't that interesting? Because the Americans are looking at Iran as a better version of the East. Of the Orient, of the Muslim world. So both of these countries early on in their history look past their great nemeses and they kind of find a more distant kind of friend, right? East of Eden, West of Europe, whatever you want to call it, a friendlier version. And I think that remains well into the, you know, at least 1950s, 60s, maybe even into the 1970s among the Iranian elite. They look at the U.S., you know, less and less so after Vietnam, but you know, they look at the U.S. as a kind of nicer, friendlier version of the West. This is so interesting, right? So you're familiar with the 1953 coup, right? I talked about that at the beginning. as late as the early 1950s, when I looked at some of the nationalist newspapers in Iran, the pro-Mossadegh newspapers, when they were critical of the U.S., when they criticized the U.S., the tone was so interesting. It was almost sad. It wasn't angry. They actually said things like, well, maybe, you know, the U.S. is kind of inexperienced on the world stage. Maybe they don't really know what they're doing. Maybe they're being misled by the British, by the evil British. This is the country of Mark Twain and, you know, all these things. And, you know, we have trouble believing that they could be, you know, doing bad things. That is so different from the tone with which they criticized the British, right? That's as late as 1951, 52, 53, right before the CIA coup against Mossadegh. Mossadegh himself, one of the last letters he wrote as prime minister was to Eisenhower. 3 weeks before Eisenhower himself gave the order to have Mossadegh overthrown. Mossadegh needed more money because the British were embargoing and sanctioning Iran. And who did he turn to? Who did he think was be the one country that would understand Iran's plight? The United States. He wrote this very pleading letter to Eisenhower saying, you know, we help us, we need $45 million for our annual budget. He got no response from Eisenhower. Or he got a very terse response from Eisenhower. Said, you know, yeah, you have to understand, you know, we... Because by that point, Eisenhower had already decided, had already given the go-ahead for the coup, for Operation Ajax, overthrow Mossadegh. That's extraordinary when you think about it, right? That's how much changed in 1953. Now, I'm not trying to put all the blame on the U.S. or to say that 1953 is when all the problems began, because, you know, of course, it's complex, and it wasn't a perfect world before 1953. And, of course, in 1979, the hostage crisis made everything a lot worse. But here's what I am kind of trying to get at. Everyone sitting in this room today, or this virtual room, I think we all understand instinctively, even if you don't know much about U.S.-Iran relations, that things are bad. And so you come to me, maybe, as a historian, and you say, help us understand how things got so bad. Well, to some extent, that's the job of a historian, sure, to help you understand, you know, how things got so bad, yes. But they're embedded in that, implicit in that question. There's another question that is never asked, but it's almost taken for granted, which is, well, if things got so bad, they must have at some point been good. So what's that about? What does that look like? How did things get so good in the first place? Or did they? We don't know. Most people don't know. I will maintain this. Even for people who like to focus on the 1953 coup and say everything was fine until the US overthrew it. Okay, fine. You can have that opinion. But then tell me, the follow-up question is, okay, so everything was great before that? Okay, what is that? What did that look like? Tell me what that looked like. Usually people have, I mean, you have no idea. It's this idea that there was this kind of perfect world. Yeah, I would actually argue that you could make the case that in the 1910s, 1920s, 1930s, there was a sort of golden age of U.S.-Iran relations. Yeah, but I think most people would be really hard-pressed to describe what that was about, what that looked like. I think it's just as interesting to understand how things went right in the first place as it is to understand how things went wrong. Because when you focus on how things went wrong, you're looking for blame, you're looking for victims, oppressors, culprits. When you look at how things went right, you're looking for some nobler instinct of humanity. And that is not a bad place to start when you're talking about the history of U.S.-Iran relations. Why do we always have to start with the last 40 years and how horrible everything is? I mean, that's a reality, and I'm happy to talk about that in the Q&A. But we could just as easily talk about the 200 years of very positive, warm feelings and relations between these two countries. Because I think that when we do that, we start to think about the kind of world that is possible again. And I believe, and I'm very naive, people, you can say I'm naive, idealistic, but I believe that we can get back there again. I really do. Because that a lot of the logic of that is still in place. And why shouldn't these two countries ultimately be friends? I know that's not going to happen tomorrow. But when we only look at the negative history of the recent years, we already make that impossible. We already go to history as a weapon and as a kind of competitive sport. And that's just not productive. So I'm going to end on that, hopefully somewhat positive, rosy note, because I have a feeling that in the Q&A, everything's going to kind of go straight downhill, because we'll talk about the scabrous realities that we face today. So thank you. And I'm very happy to take your question.
Thank you so much. That was a really unique perspective. I am wondering, moving forward, where do you kind of envision U.S. and Iran relations going from here?
I appreciate that question. Obviously, as a historian, I'm much more comfortable in the past than I am in the future, even more comfortable in the past than I am in the present. I think in the immediate future, obviously, the big question is the JCPOA, and will the United States return to it, and will the architecture of conversation, negotiation that was created by the Obama administration be resurrected in some way? The short answer to that is, look, Iran has a presidential election coming up in June. Again, we often only look at the American perspective. Iran has a presidential election coming up in June. Iran's constitution limits the president to 2 terms, just like the U.S., 2 4-year terms. And the current incumbent president, Hassan Rouhani, is at the end of his second term. So there will be a new government. There will be a new president, a new foreign minister probably in place after June. That gives us a very, very short amount of time to operate, or the Biden administration, a very short amount of time to operate. Here's the good news. President Rouhani and his foreign minister, Javad Zarif, are very much invested in the idea of the JCPOA and better relations with the United States. And they're going to be very invested in trying to resurrect it. Why? Ever since the United States exited the JCPOA, Rouhani and Zarif have been humiliated by that. Because basically hardline anti-American elements in Iranian politics, I mean, they've been able to say very convincingly and very reasonably, you see, you can't trust America. It is really unlikely that anything other than a hardline and much more anti-American president is going to win the election in June. You are not going to win an election in Iran right now on a platform of better relations with the United States. The withdrawal from the JCPOA saw to that. Except unless, by some miracle, Rouhani and Zarif are able to pull a rabbit out of their hats and actually renegotiate the JCPOA with the Biden administration in the next 3 or 4 months. That would change the narrative and get some sanctions relief. Right? That's the only weapon they have against their more conservative hardline rivals. So they have a really strong built-in incentive for trying to do this, to preserve their legacy and so on, and to keep their kind of friends in power. On the U.S. side, a lot of the people in the Biden administration were personally involved in the negotiation of the JCPOA, the nuclear deal with Iran. A lot of them know one another, and they've worked on this together. And they are also invested in resurrecting that. So both sides have some real reasons for wanting, but it's not going to be that easy. I mean, you have rivals, regional rivals, close U.S. allies in the region, namely, especially Israel and Saudi Arabia, that are not going to sit around and make it easy. They really don't like the idea of closer relations between the U.S. and Iran, and they're going to introduce obstacles and challenges as much as they can. That's going to be the challenge. And, of course, the other big challenge is that it's not like Joe Biden has nothing else to do. There are some really, really pressing American priorities with the pandemic and, of course, this kind of difficult moment of sort of democratic dysfunction that we're in the United States as well. So, I mean, he's got a pretty intense inbox. But I will maintain he cannot afford to ignore Iran, because you've only got a few months to really to do this if you're going to do it.
You're listening to John Razvinyan on the hidden history of U.S.-Iran relations. This is Independent Alternative Radio. Stay tuned at the end to learn how you can get copies of this program and for our special book offer, Retargeting Iran, a collection of interviews I did on Iran. Our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. If you'd like a free printed transcript, PDF, or MP3 of this program, just give us a call, 1-800-444-1977.
What did you find about Iranians' reaction to the Allied occupation of Iran during World War II?
Iranian reactions to the occupation of Iran, of Iran in World War II? That's a fantastic question. A lot of Americans don't even know this. This is one of the great untalked about fronts in the U.S. war effort. 30,000 American GIs were stationed in Iran from 1943 to 1945. It was the first real large-scale contact between ordinary Americans and ordinary Iranians. The Presbyterian missionaries had been there for 100 years before that, but there were only a few hundred of them. They did a lot for their small numbers, but it was not, suddenly you had 30,000 American GIs stationed in what was called the Persian Gulf Command and creating the Persian Gulf Corridor, which was the idea was to get lend-lease supplies from the British positions in the Persian Gulf up to the Soviet positions in the north. They used the Trans-Iranian Railway and truck convoys and so on to get huge numbers. I mean, it was actually a critical part of the war effort. It never gets talked about. Operation Barbarossa, Hitler had moved into the Soviet Union, and there was no other way to get supplies to the Soviets except using Archangel or the northern route, really complicated routes. But across Iran was the perfect route. So they used the Trans-Iranian Railway, and they used Americans to do this. And the Iranian reaction, it was mixed. Honestly, it wasn't. There were very few of these veterans still left alive, and I would actually love to hear from some of them. Many of them, had really nice, positive relations with their hosts and so on. But unfortunately, a lot of them, there was a lot of drinking and frequenting of brothels and things like that didn't really rub the population the right way. I think this was a very difficult time in Iran. I've heard these stories actually from my father, who would happily talk about, he has memories of, listening to, hearing the sounds of American soldiers fornicating, on a hot summer night, outside the window, right? In the sort of suburbs of Iran, right? In movie theaters, for example. That obviously didn't rub people the right way. But I don't want to say it was an uniquely a negative thing. It's actually a shame, because actually the British and the Russians were behaving much, much worse towards Iran at the time. The Soviets were hoarding grain supplies during a very difficult winter. The Americans actually probably were treating Iran better than any other. So there were three occupying powers, I should have mentioned that. The Soviets, the Americans, and the British, the three allies, were all in occupation. The Soviets in the north, the British in the south, and then the Americans were doing the railway. The Americans are probably behaving better than anyone, but unfortunately they were the most visible and so on and so forth. But you're right. This was the first kind of experience they had, and they would refer to the GIs as Johnny. They would use this word as they kind of walked by and so on.
All right. Well, thank you for that answer. Our next question comes from Jess, and Jess asks, can you talk a little bit about the research you did in Iran and what it was like to visit Iranian government archives while doing research for the book?
Yeah, so I went to Iran three times for the research for this book, and it was very important to me to get some access to Iranian archives, because I think this is one of the problems with the way this history is told. It's the same problem there is with everything when it comes to U.S.-Iran relations, which is you have people who only have access to U.S. archives who tell a certain kind of story, because it's a story that emerges out of U.S. archives. And you have people who only have access to Iranian archives and also are operating in a more closed political environment, and who are telling a certain kind of story because of that, and aren't able to come to the U.S. and do research, here and so on. I was in a unique position of being able to, because I was born in Iran, was able to go in on an Iranian passport and visit archives, and also do work in the United States. Iran has a law that every government ministry has to deposit its archives in the National Archives, but unfortunately, the Foreign Ministry, and I believe also the Defense Ministry, are actually exempt from that rule. And they are very, very difficult to get access to. And I spent day after day after day just driving these people crazy, showing up every day at the Foreign Ministry archive and just working around their endlessly Byzantine kind of rules and weird opening hours and just the lack of real interest or desire to want to let me in. But eventually, was able to start doing some work and only managed to get up to the sort of 1920s. It was difficult to look at documents beyond that, but managed to get access to documents that people hadn't really looked at much before from outside Iran. And that was important to me, and it made a real difference, especially to the early part of the history. But I also traveled around Iran and looked at kind of sites of historical interest, that were related to the U.S., the old American schools, graveyards. There are pictures on my website if people are interested. I went to this tiny village called Sir, which is on the outskirts of Urmia, almost impossible to get to. You have to go up this boulder-strewn path that somehow a car can barely get by, and you go up there, and that's where the first American church built by Joseph Cochran in the 1850s was, and the first American school, boys' school, built around the same time. And there is a cemetery, an American cemetery, in this tiny village in the middle of nowhere up on this mountain. And it still says on the side, chiseled in the stone, American Presbyterian Missionary, 1855. This is one of the most forgotten about repositories of American remains anywhere in the world. There's about 50 or so gravestones, graves of Americans who were born and raised and died in Iran, who never even saw the United States, right? Generations of Presbyterian missionaries. And it's a fascinating place. So it was important for me to kind of see and feel that aspect of the story as well, in addition to just going to archives. It's a certain kind of archive as well, I believe.
Our next question comes from Randolph, and Randolph is wondering if you can discuss the history of Iran and Israel's relations and what you see in the future.
So Iran never recognized Israel officially before the Islamic Republic, but it did have a sort of de facto relationship with Israel. There was a sort of unofficial Israeli embassy in Iran and vice versa. And they had very, very close relationship with the Shah's government. Of course, Iran also had one of the, and still has to this day, the actually largest Jewish population in the Middle East outside Israel. It was larger, of course, before the revolution, but it is still pretty significant, 25 to 30,000, maybe more. It's a very complex relationship, but I think it's often very poorly understood. And it's a very loaded one, of course. Iran's official position on this is that it is anti-Zionist rather than anti-Semitic. And that is something that people can, you are welcome to debate, but that is sort of their official position. The Ayatollah, when he first came to power, met with Iran's Jewish community and went out of his way to kind of reassure them that they would always be safe in Iran, and that Iran would always have a strong animus towards the idea of what it would describe as Israel's occupation of Palestinian territory. And it has always maintained that line. Today's animosity, I would say, it's interesting. I mean, Trita Parsi writes about this very effectively. The irony is that in the 1980s, when Iran was at its most revolutionary phase, rhetorically, and the most anti-Israeli and anti-Zionist and anti-American, the Israelis actually were the ones encouraging the U.S. to have a better relationship with Iran. They said, this is an aberration. Don't listen to the rhetoric. It's fine. You know, why? Because this was before the Oslo process. This is before, this is when the Arabs were the big evil, what Israel wanted to paint as the evil force in its rhetoric. And so Iran was like a nice counterforce to that. But then as soon as the Cold War ended and the Arab-Israeli peace process began, everything's changed. Suddenly, Israel didn't feel as threatened by all these Arab states, and so it started to paint the Iranians as the big bogeyman, which is ironic because that's right around the time that Iran began to moderate and become more pragmatic and less ideologically anti-Israeli in some of its rhetoric. It began to talk much more about how it would accept any solution that the Palestinians accepted, et cetera, et cetera. And these things are often very tactical. Iran was left out of the peace process, so it started to undermine the peace process. It said, if you're going to use this as a tactic to isolate us, we're going to work against it. And that's when they started to increase their support for Hezbollah and even Hamas. That's hopefully a quick answer to the question.
Thank you for that. So our next question comes from Charles, and Charles is wondering if you can discuss the history of the Western oil industry in Iran.
Again, a really understudied part of this history. Everyone who studies history tends to assume that, Iranian oil was very much British before 1953, and that's true. The British first discovered oil in Iran in 1908 at Masjid al-Suleiman, and it became the great Middle East oil prize and so on, and a critical part of the British Empire's economic viability and so on. But there was this kind of unspoken rivalry between the British and the Americans as the U.S. began to kind of rise as a power in the early 20th century. Right after the First World War, I mean, the U.S. had more oil than it knew what to do with. It didn't care about oil from other places. The U.S. was actually at one point in the early 1900s, the U.S. was actually shipping oil to Iran. Very few people know that. But suddenly, things changed in the early 1920s. The U.S. began to worry about scarcity. Some of the oil began, Oklahoma and Pennsylvania oil fields began to run out. And then it became interested. And then here, suddenly there was this rivalry between the British and the Americans, because American oil companies wanted to get into Iran, particularly the Sinclair and the Standard, what would later become Esso and Exxon and so on. I could go on for a long time about this, but there was they screwed it up, basically. It was the classic American approach of free markets. Most of the European countries at the time gave backing to their oil companies. The U.S. said, free market. These companies can go to Iran. They'll have to compete with each other. I mean, the Iranians was crazy to them. So you had both the Sinclair and the Standard Oil companies going to Iran in 1923 and competing against each other for an Iranian oil concession. And everyone thought this was nuts. They were like, well, who the hell, what are we supposed to, we thought we wanted to do an oil deal with the Americans. The Iranians really did. They really did, because they hated the British. And they wanted to do an oil deal with the U.S. But suddenly, you had these two big American oil companies competing in broad daylight. It was vicious. It was a vicious dispute. And it involved the U.S. embassy. By the way, the U.S. ambassador at the time was a rabbi, a man by the name of Joseph Kornfeld, the first American rabbi to ever serve as a diplomat, as an ambassador overseas. He supported the Sinclair, while the American financial advisor, Arthur Millspaugh, supported the Standard. And they were yelling at each other in broad daylight about this. And the Iranians didn't know, who does the U.S. actually support? And of course, the British were very good at using this and divide and conquer. And they had a much better idea what they were doing. And so the U.S. lost its opportunity to get involved in the Iranian oil bounty They tried again in the 1940s, a couple of other issues came up, and then after the 1953 coup, of course, it became a lot easier because the British kind of owed the Americans one after that, because they got rid of Mossadegh, and so they ended up internationalizing the oil consortium, and that's how US got involved much more deeply in Iranian oil.
Our next question comes from James, and James is asking, how did the shift of the U.S. from a more isolationist to a more global player complicate its diplomatic relationship with Iran?
The short answer is that they ended up overthrowing the Iranian government in 1953, and that significantly complicated its relationship with Iran. The more nuanced answer is that, so in the immediate term, right after Pearl Harbor, you know, there was huge excitement in the Roosevelt administration, FDR's administration, for the idea of becoming more involved. There was a feeling that what are we going to do after the war ends? Okay, so we have this corridor and we're getting supplies up to the Soviet Union and so on. Okay, and you can understand what they were thinking. They thought, you know, when the war ends, actually it was a very prescient. They thought when the war ends, we'll leave. The U.S. actually, to their great credit, became involved. So many of you will know the Tehran conference with Stalin and Roosevelt and Churchill, that famous picture of them sitting in Tehran talking about the Normandy invasions and all the D-Day and all this stuff. Well, one of the things they talked about at that meeting was, well, what are we going to do at the end of the war? The three great powers, we have our troops in Iran. The U.S. very much gave its backing to the idea of Iranian sovereignty and said, you know, within 6 months, they signed a so-called tripartite agreement that said within 6 months of the end of the war, we all will move our troops out and restore Iran's sovereignty. It turned out the Soviets didn't really want to do that and whatever. So one of the interesting things was the Roosevelt administration said, well, if we leave and the British leave and the Russians leave, well, the British and the Russians have a long-standing rivalry about Iran. They're going to end up competing over Iran again, and Iran is going to be weak and destabilized, and you know there's a possibility for a sort of great power rivalry again. Basically, they saw the Cold War coming, and they said, we need to find some way to guarantee Iranian sovereignty and to help Iran strengthen itself and stand on its own feet so that it can not be manipulated by the Soviets, by communists, you know, by the British and so on. And, you know, obviously they were more favorable to the British, but they, you know, they said, how do we do that? And the big idea at the time, this is when this is the beginning of kind of this kind of 1950s, 60s mentality of kind of development economics and, you know, kind of, oh, let's help these countries in the third world become, you know, wealthier and more progressive and thus more pro-American. So Roosevelt administration sent three advisory missions to Iran from 1943, a military advisory mission, a gendarmerie mission, which is sort of a national policing mission run by Colonel Norman Schwarzkopf Sr., the father of the so-called Stormin Norman Schwarzkopf, and a financial advisory mission under Arthur Millspaugh, all of which, this began the first real serious American investment and involvement with the end of the kind of American isolationism. And it began the close strategic relationship between Iran, between the U.S. and between the Shah's government.
So we have two more questions here that I think will be kind of I'm going to tie them together, and we'll kind of end here. So the first half of this question comes from Amy, and Amy says, it seems like Iranians generally assimilate well into American culture, or at least more so than some many others. Why is that? And then I'm going to tack on to that this other question from Randolph that says, what is it like for Americans to visit Iran today?
Iranians assimilate into American culture better than that. Sure. I mean, I think what you're getting at, I don't think there's something inherent about Iranians. I think it's just a product of which Iranians have ended up in the United States. So very, very, very brief history of Iranian immigration to the U.S. Actually, it started around the 1890s, early 1900s, with Iranian Christians, Assyrian Christians, coming to Chicago, the near north side of Chicago, which to this day has a small Assyrian, Persian, Iranian community. But large-scale immigration began in the 1960s with Iranian students coming to the U.S. to study, many of whom were very anti-Shah and many of whom never left. But the next big wave, of course, was after the revolution. And who were those people? Well, they were mostly people who were highly dissatisfied with the idea of an Islamic Republic, or who were fleeing, or who had done very, very well under the Shah's government. They were the old elites, the wealthy, and not... This is a huge generalization, not true across the board, but in many, many cases, these were people that brought, you know, significant education and wealth with them to the United States. So they were very different from immigrants that we might get from other parts of the world that are economic migrants and so on. These were exiles from a revolution. And they were very pro-American because they, for the most, again, for the most part, there's a little bit of a parallel with like Miami Cubans, right? For the most part, this is an old elite that enjoyed the Shah's close relationship with the United States and did well out of it and really loathed to this day the Islamic Republic. So it shouldn't surprise you that you know, the overwhelming majority of the Iranian community in the United States is highly educated, well off, et cetera, et cetera. So those people tend to assimilate better into American culture. And I put this in quotes because it's not really a cultural thing. It's just people who have done well in the United States. The other part of the question, oh, what's it like for Americans to visit? Ah, great question. I hear this all the time. Oh, I'd love to go to Iran. But you know, no, you can go to Iran. You can go to Iran. Don't be afraid to go to Iran. Don't get scared off by a lot of the headlines you hear. Okay. You're not going to get arrested and beaten, all the rest of it. That's not going to happen. Tens of thousands of Iranians go back, well, they did before the travel ban and all kinds of things, you know, but generally speaking, go back and forth between Iran and the United States every year. I'm not saying no one ever has problems, but the ones you hear about, the few cases you hear about are serious and significant, but they don't represent the overwhelming majority. That's Iranian Americans, but plenty of non-Iranian Americans also go to Iran. Now, not in huge numbers, but mostly I would say because of the kind of the fear factor. But there are people who are either married to Iranians who go and who generally come back saying they had a very nice time. But there are also organized tour groups. You can do this. The biggest challenge is the visa. That will take you a couple of months to get. That's not easy. There's a lot of, but you know, you can get it. This is a difficult time. The last couple of years, 4 years has been a particularly difficult time. I wouldn't have advised, and I haven't myself been to Iran in the last few years. It has been a very tense time between the two countries. Maybe not the best idea, but you can still do it. Now maybe it'll be a little bit better. Or in the 2015, it was pretty good. You know, there are moments you have to kind of read the politics a little bit, but you can go on organized tours. The New York Times was doing these tours a couple years ago. I mean, there are other tour groups that do this. I don't recommend independent solo American travel in Iran. That's not a good idea. That can be easily misunderstood. And you can easily stumble into raising suspicions and so on. Having said that, that doesn't mean that you're going to get a sanitized version. I mean, yeah, you'll get a certain whatever. But, you know, it's an incredible country to visit. Everyone who goes, Americans who go, they all say the same thing. They cannot believe how hospitable and warm and friendly people are to Americans. Way more, this is what you hear again and again, way more than people in other parts of the Middle East. That shouldn't surprise you. When your government is ideologically and officially anti-American, you know, and you've been cut off 40 years from the United States, and let's, you know, you're going to get a lot of people who are actually kind of pro-American, who like Americans, and you find that a lot in Iran. When your government is, say this politely, when your government is seen by its citizens as being a sort of instrument of American foreign policy, as is in the case in places like Egypt, for example, or under Mubarak, or, but, you know, other countries as well in the region, it shouldn't be surprising that people who are resentful of their government, who are angry with it, you know, are going to be more anti-American. And that's where you're more likely to actually end up in, you know, in kind of dangerous situations. If I'm just a non-Iranian American, I would much sooner go to Iran than Pakistan. And this is no disrespect to Pakistan. I would love to go there personally, and I hope I do someday. It looks like an incredible country, but I mean, you're going to be a lot safer. You know, you're going to have a nice time. So, and it's really cheap. And the best part about it is you get to go to places like Isfahan and Persepolis, some of these great world heritage sites, and almost no tourists. That's what really blew my mind. I'm walking around in Isfahan, in one of the UNESCO World Heritage Sites, this incredible, incredible place in Persepolis. There's almost no one. There's a couple of Japanese and German tour groups, but that's it. That's the equivalent place anywhere else in the world, you know. You know, you can't even see anything because you're surrounded by literally like, you know, 100,000 tourists and selfie sticks. And so it's an incredible experience and it's cheap. So I recommend it. I hope Iranians get to visit the United States more easily as well, you know, because obviously things have been very, very difficult the last few years.
You were just listening to John Razvinyan on the hidden history of U.S.-Iran relations. John Razvinyan is the executive director of the Middle East Center at the University of Pennsylvania. He spoke in Philadelphia in late January. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and progressive and in our 35th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.com. alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs of today's program, John Razvinyan on the Hidden History of U.S.-Iran Relations, and for Retargeting Iran, a book of interviews I did with Noam Chomsky, Azadeh Moaveni, Trita Parsi, Ervant Abrahamian, and Nader Hashemi. Call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. We can go to our website, alternativeradio.org. If you'd like a free copy of a printed transcript, PDF, or MP3 of this program, just give us a call at 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Parisa of Iran, singing Bayate Raje.
آن را که چنین دردی از پای در اندازه thank you.
So that concludes this week's edition of Gray Matters. We'll be back next week with another hour-long presentation from Alternative Radio down in Boulder, Colorado. Check out their website at www.alternativeradio.org. Coming up on CKUT is Dromatext in an hour of spoken word recordings, and we'll get to it after a little bit of station business. Till next week.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Contre la COVID-19 est en cours, mais l'ensemble de la population n'est pas encore protégée. Même si vous êtes vacciné, vous devez continuer d'appliquer les mesures sanitaires. Portez un masque, maintenez la distanciation physique et lavez-vous les mains régulièrement. En cas de symptômes, passez un test de dépistage et respectez les consignes d'isolement. Apprenez-en davantage sur les mesures au québec.ca/coronavirus. Respectons les règles, tout le temps, sans exception. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Good evening and welcome to the May 13th edition of Dromatext. Tonight we'll be celebrating the work of Lawrence Ferland Getty, who passed away recently at the age of 101. This is a reading that took place as part of the University of California at Berkeley's Lunchtime Poetry Series. So without further ado, here's Lawrence Ferland Getty.
Hello and welcome to Lunch Poems in the Morrison Library. I can just feel the excitement bubbling in the room here today. I want to thank you all for being here. And I just want to mention we do have a mailing list by the librarian's desk, and we still have 4 more readings coming up in the spring. We'll take a little break here, but we'll be back February 2nd with Saskia Hamilton, so please come back for that. And just a few things. Zach Rogo is here. He's the former Lunch Poems coordinator and one of its founders. He'll be introducing Lawrence Ferland Getty, and Robert Hess will introduce Zach Rogo. And Zach just wanted me to mention... There's a chain of events.